Welcome to Not So Different, a podcast from the Center for Biosimilars. I'm your host, Senior Editor Kelly Davio. Among the biggest biosimilars news of this year was the launch of the first two anti-cancer biosimilars. Stakeholders have been eager to see whether these products can jumpstart what has been described by some as a sluggish U.S. market for biosimilar products. This week on the podcast, we're speaking with an expert who's sharing her insight into these developments in the oncology space and what we can learn from them. Christina Corridon is a principal in the professional services firm ZS Associates. Christina is a leader in ZS's oncology practice, and she leads their biosimilars vertical. Christina joined us to talk about the state of play in the U.S. biosimilars market, what we can learn from ongoing experience, and how sustainable the U.S. market for biosimilars may be today. Christina, thank you so much for joining us for this episode of Not So Different.
Thanks, Kelly. Happy to be here.
Well, let's start with an overview of where things stand today. What is the current state of play in the U.S. market for oncology biosimilars, and what, in your opinion, have been some of the biggest developments this year?
Sure. So the U.S. landscape is, unlike Europe, I would say not considered mature in the biosimilar landscape. We've had biosimilars with the launch of Zarxio from Sandoz. And since then, we haven't seen any therapeutic oncology biosimilars launch until earlier this year. In fact, just in July, there were two that launched, Mevazi and Kanjinti from Amgen. And this is interesting to note for a few different reasons. First, these are the first biosimilar launches that Amgen has had in the U.S. marketplace. And then, as I mentioned, these are the first therapeutic oncology biosimilar launches. There's 23 biosimilars approved, but approved doesn't mean launch in this marketplace, right? So given patent protection, well, largely patent protection, some of these molecules or assets have to wait until they're able to launch, even after the FDA has approved them. It's interesting also to note that aside from oncology, the major therapeutic area that has seen biosimilars enter the marketplace a few years ago would be in the autoimmune or immunology space, with versions of Remicade or Infliximab coming from Merck and Pfizer, Inflectra and Renflexis. And there's been a bit of a lackluster performance just in terms of the market share they've been able to achieve, which demonstrates that the originator still has quite a few levers in order to retain market share. There's probably many reasons why it is what it is, with many largely attributing it to the rebating and contracting that Janssen has been able to do to make, in many cases, certain segments of the marketplace actually more profitable using the originator than the biosimilars.
So let's talk a little bit about launch price. We've certainly heard some U.S. stakeholders say that they want to see biosimilars launch at discounts as substantial as what we've seen in the European Union. And these first two anti-cancer products have launched at a relatively modest 15%. What has been the response? What's been the attitude toward the launch prices for these drugs?
Yeah, I think generally speaking, on paper, the discount may not look significant, but this is a discount over WAC, so it really doesn't shed light on what the actual ASP for the Amgen products will be. You know, so there could be, and I mean, there likely are greater discounts and rebates that are happening behind the scenes that could be offered to certain customer groups, or that could kick in as an account or entity is able to convert over a large population or a disproportionate population of their patients over to the biosimilar, in which case they would be eligible for such rebates, et cetera. But some of the early discussions we've had with providers in this space have shown that they have seen it to be financially helpful. That they are seeing a net price that's competitive with these biosimilars that would drive them to start utilizing them and encouraging their practice to also utilize them.
And in terms of the utilization of these products, how much are we seeing new starts being given these biosimilars versus patients who are already on therapy being switched?
Sure. Now, this is a great question because I think the topic of switch is particularly important and a little bit controversial in the biosimilar landscape. It's more controversial in the autoimmune immunology space because you have stable patients that, you know, if you switch them, there could be some immunogenicity concern. You know, if you have an ulcerative colitis patient, gastroenterologists often will say it's sort of a sleeping baby. You wouldn't want to do anything to disrupt that. And there could be a lot of reluctance that switching to the biosimilar could change, you know, the status of that stable patient. In therapeutic oncology, it's different, right? So there's various patient subtypes, but it's largely more of an acute disease. Some of these patients may be getting a limited number of cycles of the drug. So the switch topic is probably important at launch in terms of how fast Amgen can achieve market share, but over time could be far less important. So if you're an account, you may be deciding today, you know, of the patients that have started some cycles, you know, they're not, the concept of stable is not really there, right? You're hoping that they'll be responsive, that it'll help alleviate their disease, et cetera. But you wouldn't necessarily be able to attribute disease progression to biosimilar switch per se, right? There's many other factors that could be at play there. That all being said, I think what we're hearing so far is that there is definitely a hesitation to go completely all in and stop offering the originator altogether. And part of that is not just related to the clinical potential concern, Kelly, of switching an existing patient on an originator, Herceptin or Avastin, but also the fact that certain payers may not have yet converted over from the originator. You know, so if an account goes all in, they could have some challenge if they try to go and get the patient's drug reimbursed, and that particular patient's commercial payer is still sticking with the originator. So I think this idea of entities and practices and providers exclusively offering the Amgen biosimilars is something that we probably won't see for at least 6 months to a year.
So in the immunology space, we've certainly seen some plans that have preferred originator products over biosimilars, and some of the biosimilar developers have suggested that that can be due to bundled rebates that are maybe keeping more expensive products on the formulary. Do you see the potential for this to be the case with some of the anti-cancer biosimilar products?
And no, I think it's another great question. I mean, bundling can be interpreted as a bit of a bad word or something, you know, naughty that shouldn't be done. In Europe, it's actually technically illegal. You know, but portfolio contracting and leveraging one's portfolio is not. It is true that it has been interpreted that what Janssen has done is considered anti-competitive, you know, and hence some lawsuits have ensued in the sense that they have leveraged the power of their portfolio, you know, I believe all the way across various businesses, potentially even their surgical business. And so the idea that an organization has a portfolio to leverage does give them something else within their toolkit. And Amgen is a company that does have a portfolio. And what's interesting, you know, as mentioned earlier, they have a portfolio of both biosimilars and originators and novel therapeutic oncology agents. You know, so the idea of how they could tailor the rebates and discounts they might be able to give for one asset versus another, and the power of what they can provide in terms of service, reputation in the marketplace because they have so many assets across different tumor areas, it can be large, you know, and they've also been in oncology for a very long time and in biologics for a very long time. And I think in some of our early discussions the last couple of months with providers, it has come through the power of their reputation. So there's many different aspects of the portfolio aside from just the contracting. I think that also equates to just being a very known player in the marketplace. And for biosimilars, that can be very helpful because if there's any doubts or concerns about the organization's ability to supply or provide high-quality, safe biologics, a lot of times what we hear referenced is the prior experience that providers or payers may have had with that organization. So that all being said, we have an example in the marketplace of a company, Coherus, with, you know, one product, Udenyca, and you know, they've been able to be very successful gaining market share fairly quickly. And so I think that shows in of itself that you can still be financially beneficial even with one asset. And I think there's some challenge with portfolio contracting in the sense that providers and payers won't like it if they feel handicapped, in the sense of if they don't perform well with one asset within the portfolio, but they perform great with others, are you holding back rebates because of the lackluster performance with one? So it's tricky in terms of customer experience also. The variability in the performance that could happen across the portfolio and what that might mean in terms of how the contract has been designed.
So as you look ahead to the next couple of months in the marketplace, what are some developments that you're going to be watching closely?
Sure. So I think on the policy front, there have been a few suggestions put forth around making the market more attractive to utilize biosimilars, and more attractive for biosimilar manufacturers to continue to make investments in the space and go to market, such as offering an ASP plus 8% for biosimilars is one example there. So we'll be watching these policy proposals that have been put forth. I think on the flip side, there are, you know, in the 340B category, right? So 340B status right now is an advantage for biosimilars that have more recently launched that have been able to achieve pass-through status, right? So this means that using the biosimilar, if you're a 340B entity, can be more profitable than using the originator. So that's another thing that we'll be watching to see if that that benefit continues for biosimilars. Another interesting, you know, development that we'll want to continue to watch is the various launches that will occur. So, you know, we've heard that Pfizer has several launches upcoming within the next year or so. I believe even from some discussions on podcasts like these, they've shared that. So the next organization that launches in therapeutic oncology and with a rituximab, which is in the heme space, we'll want to watch how those launches go, what the discount is, what the uptake looks like, et cetera. So I think a combination of policy, go-to-market strategy and different launches that may go forth, as well as what uptake will look like and what market share is able to be gained and how quickly.
And certainly one interesting development that we've already seen is United Healthcare preferring the two Amgen products over the reference products for their community and commercial plans. What does that development mean for the U.S. biosimilar space?
Sure. And now this is definitely a hot news line that we've seen in terms of Amgen's strategy and what they've been able to achieve. And it's even broader than their biosimilars being preferred, right? So on the originator side, they were able to achieve similar status with Neulasta and Onpro, which shows that essentially they are able to benefit from having this portfolio, as we discussed earlier. In terms of what this means, so United Healthcare is a payer, and for an infused biologic, of which Avastin and Hengenti are both infused oncology oncolytics, it's more complex than just winning with the commercial payer, because there's still contracting going on at an provider level, right? You know, these drugs are administered oftentimes in outpatient clinics or within hospitals. And so they're buying and billing these products. There's financial stake in the game for these provider entities. So they have a population of patients that may be disproportionately United Healthcare, which could push a particular hospital to just prefer the Amgen biosimilars as well as Neulasta Onpro over other competitive assets. Yet that in and of itself may not be sufficient because they may have a population of patients where the preference is different, right? The preference might be on the pegfilgrastim side, you know, Udenyca or Fulphila from the biosimilars, or the preference could be still with the originator for their non-United Healthcare patients, so Herceptin and Avastin. So in those cases, you would need to, as an account, continue to kind of buy and bill various products from different manufacturers. And so as you see, you know, third and fourth and fifth biosimilars launch, it could get pretty complicated for some of these accounts if commercial payers continue to kind of have their preference and an account makeup is composed of a variety of different patients from different payers. So this is where I think there's a dichotomy that you'll have to think through as a manufacturer in terms of what your exclusivity may look like at a commercial payer versus at a provider site. You know, and there's other entities within the value chain, like group purchasing organizations, GPOs, and also we heard that OneOncology, which is a community oncology GPO-type organization, has also started to prefer Amgen's biosimilars and is recommending their use among their members. So there are various influencers here in the value chain, and it's certainly a promising development for Amgen that they have this UHC preference, where they could potentially lock out other utilization amongst those UHC patients. But it's not as simple as winning accounts that may be made up of more variability in patient payer mix.
Let's also touch on the idea of sustainability. So we see companies like Amgen making certainly these big strides forward, and we also see some companies like maybe Momenta that are cutting some assets from their biosimilar pipeline. How sustainable do you see the U.S. biosimilars market being today?
I don't think it's an easy yes, it is, or yes, or no, it isn't answer, right? And I think a lot of it is hinging on these therapeutic oncology launches, the entree of a new company like Amgen into the marketplace and seeing how they fare, seeing how a Genentech responds, and then also understanding and appreciating how many more launches may be ahead in coming years. We know that Sandoz will be unable to launch their etanercept for many more years given recent legal developments. So that's a very large autoimmune asset which will be held back from launching for some time. So I think the idea that you might be waiting longer and longer to launch could be potentially discouraging to some manufacturers. It could also encourage them to speed up their R&D program and get more assets in the pipeline. But I think this is still something that we're watching, and this is certainly a banner critical year for biosimilars in the U.S. marketplace. I think a more competitive marketplace leads to cost savings. I think on another topic related to sustainability is the question of how deep discounts may need to go to drive uptake and what that might mean in terms of the profitability for some of these organizations. So sustainability is, I believe, twofold. First, is the marketplace encouraging enough that manufacturers want to be in this space? They want to continue to develop and invest in going to market, which currently is very similar in cost to going to market with an originator. On a different topic, let's say many biosimilars are able to launch, but they have to go in at deeper and deeper discounts to get that share. And there's many biosimilars for particular assets, like for adalimumab, Humira, there could be 8+ biosimilars that launch simultaneously, which could create an incredibly competitive environment where the price could drop dramatically very, very quickly. That may not be sustainable either. So in an act of desperation, in order to provide, such a compelling price to the market to drive your volume very fast, that may not be something that is long-term profitable for an organization. And while that could be good for the healthcare system in the short term, in the long term, that could be, quite negative if it puts some of these organizations out of business, or they realize that their biosimilar business is just not profitable anymore and they must divest it and they decide to become a purely innovative, originator-focused organization.
Well, Christina, thank you again for sharing your insights with our audience today. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Kelly.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Not So Different. Remember, if you like the show, you can rate us at iTunes. Until next time, find us at centerforbiosimilars.com.